they've been hiding from themselves may come up. In the movie, The Empire Strikes Back, Master Yoda, Jedi Master, he's up here behind me in the choir loft by Martin Luther King Jr. and St. Francis there. He trains young Luke Skywalker. He tells Luke that he feels the dark side in a cave. So Luke goes into this cave by himself in the stillness and quiet, and he faces his enemy, his fear, Darth Vader. Who I brought there is by the flowers. Anyway, when he in this cave, he unmasks Darth Vader, and there he finds his worst fear, that the face he reveals under the mask is his own face, that he is his own worst enemy. Often, when we're finally ready to face our fears, most of the energy from them has dissipated. The dark side can be thought of our actions in the past or our negative thoughts about the past. So I invite you to sit in that silence every day, maybe for a short time or longer if you can. And in that silence, if dark thoughts, the dark side comes up, take some notes, write it down, write down what comes up for you, and then trash them. Throw them away. Toss them in the garbage. So with that, I invite you to repeat after me. I embrace and trash the dark side.
I embrace and trash the dark side.
And so it is.
And so it is.
Thank you.
Thank you. You want to play that? Say what? Do you want to play that theme song as he makes his exit? Thank you. Okay, and now Linda, our beautiful practitioner, will lead us in prayer.
So just take a deep breath, knowing that you are surrounded by love. Breathe in the comfort of the divine spirit. Breathe in ease. Breathe in peace. And I know that everyone here that is putting together this service and attending this service, and everyone that is watching this service today or in the future, is connected to the divine love, divine spirit, divine peace. And I know that as our service unfolds, we will be inspired by beautiful music that will touch our heart. I know that the words that are said will resonate in your heart and soul. I know that as you took the time to come in for a blessing today, that that blessing is now received. And I know that the words and the feelings and the intention of this center is to resonate love. And as we embark on Monday and Martin Luther King Day, I know that we also, together, support the dream of peace, love, and human kindness in ourselves so that it can resonate out. It begins in our own heart. Embrace your own love for self and humanity as you attend this service, hear this beautiful music, and know that you are supported on a journey of love, in your world and the entire world. I am so thankful for this center. I'm so thankful for this teaching. I am so thankful for the truth that keeps us my center board and your center board, no matter what's happening on the external. Inside, love lives. I release my words and know that they're manifest. I release them into the divine law that makes them be so. And together we say, and so it is.
Thank you. And so it is, and so we allow it to be. As we breathe deeply and listen to the words of our sacred reading.
What to remember when waking, by David White. In that first hardly noticed moment in which you wake, coming back to this life from the other more secret, movable, and frighteningly honest world where everything began, there is a small opening into the new day, which closes the moment you begin to plan. What you can plan is too small for you to live. What you can live wholeheartedly will make plans enough for the vitality hidden in your sleep. To become human is to become visible, while carrying what is hidden as a gift to others. To remember the other world in this world is to live in your true inheritance. You are not a troubled guest on this earth. You are not an accident amidst other accidents. You were invited from another and greater night than the one from which you have just emerged. Now, looking through the slanting light of the morning window towards the mountainous presence of everything you can be, what urgency calls you to your one love? What shape awaits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future day? Is it waiting in the fertile sea, in the trees beyond the house, in the life you can imagine for yourself, in the open and lovely white page waiting on the desk?
And so we breathe into this present moment, honoring letting go of the past and stepping through the threshold, over the threshold of new beginnings. Whether it's personal, global, political, financial, whatever it is, we welcome the new day and recognize that it is too much for us to dream better than we can dream, but we open ourselves to receive it in all of its grace and glory. And so with that in heart and mind, let us breathe in deeply and exhale, opening our eyes in love and in service to what is, as it is, and so it is. Namaste.
Good morning to everyone here, and also our live love streamers. I'd like to welcome those who I know are with us also in spirit. We've all experienced so much stress and strife and loss in recent weeks and months, and it's so wonderful to be here and remember the joys of what it is to be alive. And Hugh, thank you. I always look forward to your readings. Love being here. I love being here with all of you. considering all that we've been going through, I know that there has to have been some time when you just wanted to escape, to just take flight, well beyond what we see, what we know on this physical plane. You can do that. That's what we know in our teachings. This is what we embrace. It's what gets us through. And long ago, Harold Arlen gifted us with a beautiful piece that takes us into that wonderment and that curiosity about a place far away. When all the world is a hopeless jumble and the raindrops tumble all around, heaven opens a magic lane. When all the clouds darken up the skyway, there's a rainbow highway to be found, leading from your window pane to a place behind the sun, just a step beyond the rain. Why? Thank you. That's Chris.
There's Brock. Thank you. Okay, welcome everybody. What a Sunday. So tomorrow is Martin Luther King Day. We're having an inauguration this week. This has been, as Dion said, quite a year, quite a last couple of weeks, and here we are in our spiritual center, celebrating, finding the good, understanding what to do next, understanding in my heart that there is a place for a new opening, for a greater yet to be, and that that part of our work is to understand that everybody deserves peace, love, and healing, and that until those qualities are not embodied in everyone, then we cannot rest. We have to continue doing the work. Now, in my case, I am drawn to doing the spiritual work. I'm not one for being in a protest and waving a sign. It's not my way. But I am so called to do the spiritual work that allows me to see differently and allows me to invite the world in to see in a way that lifts all of us up. And so that's my theme for today. I'm talking about the quality of curiosity. And while curiosity may not be a cure for some of our current challenges in the world and in this country, curiosity certainly is an important aspect, because through curiosity, we get to look at our biases and we see where we are othering somebody that we're calling the other, where we are shutting people out, and that we can let go of those defenses and allow those people to be in. And hopefully, as we're also looking at our own biases and inviting people to look at theirs, we are curious about what transpires, we allow people in, and hopefully some form of reconciliation, some greater experience of peace, love, and understanding and compassion will come through our greater experience and our greater embodiment of curiosity, specifically curiosity in looking at biases. So I'm going to tell you some tales of bias and curiosity. The first of them is from a podcast that I've been listening to by Pastor Brian McLaren. He is a progressive Christian minister, and he's doing a podcast with Father Richard Rohr and also a black preacher named Reverend Jackie Lewis, who works in New York. And it's a podcast called How Can We Learn to See? Or something like that. And in it, he explores lots of different biases, but I was struck by this story that he told. When he started out in his ministry, he worked in a church that was very, very traditional. I would say a fundamentalist Christian church. And in that church, they felt that gay people were living out of alignment with the Spirit of Christ. And so there was a lot of pushback. I don't know whether they were one of those love the quote-unquote sinner, hate the sin, or whether they would kick people out if they were gay, but they're just gay people were not welcome. The LGBTQ community was not welcome into his church, and this was a long time ago before they were calling it LGBTQ. So anyway, they were part of this group discussion, this listserv that he had with his congregation, and privately, one of the members of this listserv, where they would discuss various theological issues, one of the members of this listserv, I'll call him John, he confessed to the preacher, to Brian, the preacher, that he was gay and he was feeling uncomfortable. And so the preacher said, well, you know, continue dialoguing with me. We'll see where this goes. He was curious about this young man's experience. Brian was curious about John's experience. And so they dialogued and they had these beautiful exchanges where they were really expressing the love of the Christ consciousness. And then Brian, the minister, made a huge mistake, and he confessed it on this podcast, which I really admired. He was attempting to respond to John, his gay congregant, and instead he sent it out to the entire church. Let me pause here for a minute. Did anybody have a little clutch of fear in some part of your anatomy, having done that yourself? Yes. I have on several occasions, and it never feels good. And even when I almost have, and I've caught myself, and it's usually about revealing something confidential, even when I almost have and I've caught myself, and I know I haven't, I found myself going back to that same email 20, 30, 40, 50 times a day just to make sure I didn't send it to everybody. So anyway, this preacher, Brian, sent it to everybody in the church, and almost immediately he realized his mistake. Now, there was some debate about what was going on. Some of the church members wanted to reach out to John. Some of the church members were opposed to his orientation. But Brian felt horrible. He felt that it was the ultimate betrayal that he could give to a congregant to display, to put something personal on display. And so he approached this congregant, John, with humility and hope for understanding, compassion, shame for himself, and curiosity about what was going on in John's life after this unfortunate email. He said John didn't hug him when he came in the room. He stood on the other side of the room, but they talked it out amongst each other. And at the end, John said, "I forgive you. I forgive you from the bottom of my heart." And Brian said that it was probably the boldest expression of Christian love, Christian forgiveness that he had seen in any of his congregants ever. And what he would have missed had he dismissed that guy for his orientation. His curiosity led him, and his willingness and his compassion led him to a greater perception of reality where he couldn't put this guy, John, in a box and say, "This is who you are. This is only who you are." No, he broke out the sides of that box and he opened it up and saw the truth, the beauty of this mosaic, this puzzle that is everyone. And he took the puzzle out of the box and he put part of it together and saw the beauty of the Christ in this young man. And that changed the course of his ministry forever. He could no longer be in a church that discounted the experience of gay people. That's a story that was on a podcast. I think it's in a book, too. I'm going to tell you another story that's on a more personal level, and this is about my friend. Her name is Sejong, and she's a Korean immigration lawyer, progressive, who is Catholic and pro-life. Say that 10 times fast. That's an unusual configuration of parts, isn't it? And once a long time ago, she sent me an email and she said that she had gone to a feminist rally and that she was with some people that were particularly angry, and she, for some reason she happened to mention that she was pro-life. And the feminists were incredibly angry with her for saying that, and they told her, "You have no business being a feminist if you are pro-life." And so she felt ashamed and she reached out to me and she said, not that I know, but you know, she reached out to me and said, "Can I be a feminist and be pro-life?" And I said, "Of course you can. Of course you can. We're more complex than the boxes people want to put us in." Recently, she texted me and actually gave me permission to tell this story. She texted a whole group of people that we're in this conversation with, and she said that she had written to one of her friends who is on the other political side, a conservative, and she had talked about how she is for the president-elect Biden, but she's also pro-life. And the friend wrote back to her in such an angry manner and said, "You can't be both. You have to be consistent in your politics." And Sejong said, "You know, for a while I was an atheist. For a while I defined myself as an atheist feminist, but now I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian and I'm pro-life and I don't want to lose that. And I also don't want to lose you as a friend." Well, in my curiosity, after I received this email, I noted that she said she was Christian in the beginning of her life, she was an atheist in the middle of her life, and then she's a Christian again. And I was curious. I asked her, "How did you make that transition? How did you make that transformation? What was that like for you?" And she told me about her upbringing. She was raised in Bangladesh for many years with her parents, who were Korean missionaries. And she said that her father literally risked his life every day crossing a river to get to one of the two hospitals that he served, and then he would have to cross the river back to serve at another hospital. And she said that to her, pro-life was pro-gentleness, pro-humility, pro-caring for our brothers and sisters, pro-lifting up the best and bringing out the best in everybody. At that time, that was her definition of pro-life. And then she moved to the States, and she couldn't identify with certain Christian organizations here. I'm not saying that all Christians are like that. I know many Christians that are very, very open. But certain Christian organizations here that were very sort of adamant about what you needed to believe. She couldn't identify with them, so she was ashamed of being a Christian, so she started telling people that she was an atheist feminist. And then she was with the atheist feminists for a while, and that's the part I was really interested in. What made you be an atheist feminist? And again, I'm not dissing feminists. I'm not dissing atheists. One of my very best friends is named Eric the Atheist. I always introduce him as that when I introduce him to people. Hello, Judy. Would you like to meet Eric the Atheist? And we all think it's fun. But I asked her, how did she make that switch? No judgment on whether or not she switched, just how did you make the switch from being an atheist into being a Christian again, a pro-life Christian again? And she said that she felt like she was in a very toxic environment, that she was in a university that was intellectually oppressive, and that you all had to believe in a certain way, and that people that were not believing in this certain way were cast out. And she said that her whole life she's been feeling cast out one way or the other. And then she went on a trip to India, and she met Mother Teresa, of all people, and she loved Mother Teresa's beauty and her power and her willingness to serve those that others would say were outcasts. And then she divorced her husband, and she ended up marrying a Catholic, and she'd converted to Catholicism. And at that point, she took on the Catholic idea of pro-life. And she says it hasn't been easy. It hasn't been easy because she is pro-life and she's liberal, and when she's talking about pro-life to liberals, they want to push her back that way, and when she's talking about liberalism to pro-life people, they want to push her back that way. They want to put her in a box that is comfortable for them. And again, how wonderful it is. I'm so blessed that I asked her about her transition without a judgment about what her answer was, just wanting to understand her, just asking her in peace and compassion and understanding, what was that like for you? What changed for you? What is it like to be who you are? Because again, I unpacked this puzzle of who she was and saw all those beautiful stories about her father and Mother Teresa and how difficult it must have been for her in college when she was denying a part of herself that wanted to express. And now here she is serving the community as an immigration lawyer and blessing so many lives. And she's pro-life. The beauty of curiosity unlocks so much for us. The beauty of curiosity requires that we step back and that we examine our own biases and that we look at where we may be labeling somebody or we look at where we may be confining somebody. I think of it, I don't think they do this anymore in crime scenes, but in the old crime shows, they used to draw a chalk outline around a dead body, right? It's quite a dead body I'm drawing there. It's like a dead starfish. But they drew a chalk outline around a dead body. And I think of that. You know, when we outline people, when we say, this is who you are based on my perception, that is death. That is death to any transformation, to any relationship of grace, to any birth of greater compassion and understanding. That is death. And so, people, we need to stop doing that. We need to stop doing that. Amen. Thank you. I heard somebody over there say an amen. Can I hear an amen from over here? Amen. Oh, good. That side won. Yeah. Thank you. Not that they're better than you. Okay. Right. Oh, goodness. We need to stop doing that. So if curiosity and openness and compassion leads us to a greater experience of life, why is it so attractive to be the opposite of that? Why is it so compelling to stick with our biases and stick with what we think we know and put people in those boxes or those chalk outlines? I think it's two things. I think it's tribalism and our compulsion, our neurological compulsion to be biased. You know, tribalism is just that we tend to be more comfortable in our own tribe. in the people that are like us. It was essential for survival at one time. And it's interesting how it has shifted over history in that now what seems to be essential for survivalism is not tribalism, it is cooperation. And cooperation is closely married to curiosity and compassion. So tribalism for our survival. You know, there's this thing called community bias, where I mentioned it before with my Korean lawyer friend, where if you step out of this side will want to pull you back, or you'll want to go back there because it's treacherous over here, or this side is making it treacherous for you, or if you step over to this side. You know, I spoke to, I think I've told you this recently, but I spoke to one of the mayors that Santa Paula had a few years back, and this was years ago. This was probably 7 or 8 years ago. We had lunch, and I asked her about the division in politics that I was starting to notice in the country, and she said the same thing is true in a small town like Santa Paula. You've got two opposing forces. This side is even curious about this side, and this side, the rest of the people on this side get really mad, and they want to cast that person out. They feel threatened by this person going over here, and the same thing happens over here on this side. This side, one person is curious, wanting to have a compassionate understanding and conversation with this side, and this side, their own side, gets threatened. Doesn't want them to leave the community, wants to pull them back so that they can justify how they feel. And that happens all the time, this community bias, and that it is extremely uncomfortable to leave the community that has brought you to greater comfort, where you feel at home, where you feel like you're not being threatened, where you feel like it's not a stretch to do something new. We are completely addicted to community bias and to comfort. The other thing is this idea of confirmation bias. You know, Hugh and I, my husband and I, watched The Social Dilemma again last night, where they talk about how social media keeps feeding you stuff that you're already interested in. So your confirmation of what is real gets reinforced over and over and over again. And they didn't make a big deal about who was doing it to whom. It's everybody is doing it to everybody. Whatever your belief is, social media is feeding you that which will confirm your belief that you already hold. And so then that belief starts feeling like the truth. When really, as you know, as we teach in this church, that there is a much greater truth that embraces all relative truth. There is absolute truth that embraces all relative truth. Because relative truth is just our perception. It is just our opinion. So there's confirmation bias. There's also conspiracy bias, that a conspiracy is really, really fascinating and really compelling. It's sort of like catastrophe bias, too. That's another name for it. You know, I was on a phone call last Friday where there was a woman who was a journalist there, and she mentioned this to us, and I found it, actually, it explained it to me really well. She said, you know how many flights there are every day in the United States? Thousands. Or every day in the world, thousands, you know? And she said, the news does not report on the ones that get there safely. The news reports on the ones that crash. There is so much good beyond what the news reports on. And gosh, I don't mean to sound paranoid, but it does seem that the news is feeding our bias pretty effectively, and that perhaps it is wise at times to step back and say, wow, this is confirmation bias. This is catastrophe bias. This is complexity bias. This is feeding something within me that may or may not be true. Why don't I relax and broaden and open my heart and see if I can see a bigger, better picture? The other bias that I thought was interesting is confidence bias. It's actually has a lot to do with religion, I think, and politics as well, but when I read about confidence bias, it said that we are more likely to believe a confident lie versus a hesitant truth. We're more likely to believe a confident lie versus a hesitant truth. And, you know, I get that. I get that so much. You know, I wonder sometimes why, you know, we're a great congregation. Why are we not, like, 10,000 strong. And this movement is a great movement. We have a beautiful, beautiful teaching that is so inclusive and so wonderful. Why are we not a million strong? And I think it's because we're not saying, this is the right way. This is our dogma. We do sometimes, but this, it's not our, as a rule of thumb. We are saying, you know, explore. We don't have all the answers. But a confident lie, a confident perception of truth is much easier for people to digest than a hesitant truth. So I'm going to tell you a confident truth. I believe in God and only God, and that God is all there is, and that God is in everything, in the adversity, in the beauty. God is in the joy. God is in the sorrow. God, if there is violence, it is God peeking through, trying to get us to wake up and understand a bigger picture where all people are treated fairly and justly and kindly. God is in the news, again, seemingly polarizing us, but also trying to get us to wake up, to wake up to a bigger picture, to wake up to Rumi's field, where beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field where the soul, where the world is food, where the soul lies down on that grass and the world is too full to talk about. Whatever God is, love, it is trying to wake us up. And it provides so many beautiful examples of how to do that. You know, I was saying the other day to some people, I was thinking about this beautiful idea that, you know, we have this diverse population. We have this beautiful, diverse population of people of all ethnicities and nationalities and races and orientations and genders and the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, all of this beautiful diversity. It seems that there is this will for the diverse in the divine, but there's also this will for unification and for oneness. And the example that I gave was that when I was in college, first time I went to college, I went to the Duke School of Nursing, and the first year and the second year students, the freshmen and the sophomores, could actually attend surgeries. We could go up and sit in the gallery and, you know, get our popcorn and watch somebody get cut open. It was super fun. and I did it a lot, you know, and the way, because I liked it. I like surgery. I like to watch it. I like all those shows, too, where there's, like, blood flinging all over the place. But that's another story. So what I noticed, you know, the patient is draped. So you don't really see anything about the patient. They've got a blue or a green drape over them, and you can barely even see their skin color sometimes because they slap betadine on it, and they put a patch over it so that they can cut through the patch to minimize infection. But when they would open up, let's say open-heart surgery, they would open up somebody, and their heart would be exposed. None of us ever said, oh, look, there's a white heart, there's a black heart, there's a racist heart, there's a non-racist heart, there's a gay heart. Oh, look at that cute little straight heart. Over here you got your pro-life heart, and over here you got your pro-choice heart. None of that. Okay, underneath the surface, there is so much sameness in us that it is ridiculous. Yes, there are anomalies. Yes, there are slight variations. But the basic construction is about the same. And the same thing with the cells. And the same thing with the DNA. And the same thing with the molecules that make up the cells. And the same thing with the atoms and the neutrons and the electrons and everything that is smaller than that make up all of that. And when you come right down to it, we are so much water. We are made of water. And beyond the water, there is empty space. And the empty space is the source. So listen, that's a confident truth. And I ask you to abide in that confident truth with me as we navigate these next weeks and this coming year and all of the above as we seek to create this beautiful world that works for everyone, that we, under the surface, are alike, and that the diversity, whether it's political, ideology, race, gender, orientation, whatever it is, that's like seasoning. It is seasoning. It is the salt of the earth that makes life spicy and fun and gives us something to do, something to transcend. So what is the practice? What is the practice? Certainly it's changing our thinking. Certainly it's being curious about our biases. And I think I said this at the beginning, but I want to be really clear. Changing our biases is certainly something to do. It's not all that we have to do, but it certainly can be the first thing that we do. is to be curious about our biases and to change them, to look at ourselves and to see where we are cutting others off through our consciousness, where we are limiting ourselves through our willingness to categorize people and put them in a box. But to bring that down to the specific level, you know, on this day before Martin Luther King Day, I think about my favorite Martin Luther King quote, which I'll paraphrase, is that you cannot drive darkness out with darkness. You need the light to do that. And you can't drive hatred out with hate. Only love can do that. And so, really, this idea of curiosity is an act of love. I'll show you how it worked for me one time. This was with a heterosexual white male, a businessman, who drove me crazy. Drove me crazy. But I was in this relationship with him where we were working together on a project. And I was so filled with judgment for him. I would talk about him behind his back. I would talk about him to myself. And I just know that there were many, many either overt or subtle eye rolls in our interactions together. And then one day, through grace, I started looking at my own prejudice. And I started thinking about this man's life, that his sister had just died, and that his father was on the way, and that he was in a marriage that was complicated, and that he had a good heart. He loved his children, and he loved his animals. And so I started silently asking the question, what is it like to be you? What is it like to be you? And I never asked it to his face, because I think he probably would have just gone, I don't want to talk about that. He's kind of a macho guy. I actually really like him now. He's a good friend now. But just asking that question, what is it like to be you, opened me up to a place where I could receive a greater truth about him, that he wasn't my judgment, that he was something so much more. And as soon as I started seeing that he was something so much more, the soon that I started switching my consciousness to a greater grace for this person, that's when confirmation bias is a really beautiful thing. I started seeing all of this evidence to support the grace that I felt about this man. If there is someone in your life that troubles you, whether it's a public figure, whether it's a personal relationship, a good thing to do might be to ask that question that I talked about. What is it like to be you? You can ask it silently. You can ask it to their face. What I do recommend is that you set up some ground rules of communication, that you're not going to, that the only thing that you say is, what is it like to be you, and let them speak. And then if you ask it again, let them speak again. And if you ask it again, let them speak again. I suspect that it will take you to a deep place through curiosity, to a place of greater compassion and understanding. The other beautiful thing that I found is that asking this question, we can ask it of ourselves. What is it like to be you? The other day I was hiking and I was by myself and I was just started pondering this idea of, Bonnie, what is it like to be? What is it like to be you? What is it like to be you? And I asked it once and I said, well, right now it's what it's like to be me is I'm a little stressed out. I got a lot to do today. Yeah, but what is it like to be you? Well, you know, I feel like I have to get all this stuff done so people will approve of me. Oh, what is it like to be you? What is it like to be you? Well, I'm feeling a bit unworthy right now, so I'm feeling unworthy. And then, when you get to that place of tenderness, that's the place that can be healed. That, perhaps, is the place that takes us somewhere over the rainbow to a greater reality, where love and beauty and triumph prevail. In the coming week, in the coming month, in the coming years, may we practice this together. There is much work to be done. But I know this confident truth that is true, that we were made for this, that we have the grace and the kindness and the heart. And on the days that we don't, we have each other to lift us up. Let us lift upward now. Let us pray.